Good morning, this is Dr. Daniel J. Guerra, and this is Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 23 March 2024. It's going to be lecture number 4 on our mosaic, that is our biochemical mosaic, on inflammasomes. So, why don't we do this initial aspect of the Saturday morning lecture with some, I don't know, exhilarating dialectic. We can do this dialectic with categorical logic and foundational epistemology. And of course, by that I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about the traditional square of opposition in logic. As first introduced by, that student of Plato's known as Aristotle. So, now, the square of opposition has been opposed in recent times. And I think most of the flaws that have been suggested in the square of opposition are really dependent upon the individual who is launching the opposition. So some of the major flaws people have suggested are, for example, what if there are no members within a given set of the square? And of course, if there are no members within a set, then you wouldn't even start to generate a square of opposition on a logical proof. So I think that that defeats itself. Other people have suggested some of the subaltern pathways could be subducted. And I've done that in the past, and I've also reprieved that in the past. And what I found is that if we use the traditional square of opposition, we can still arrive at clear logical associations so that we can eventually use those logical discoveries to finally get into a discussion of the knowledge base we're trying to generate. Okay, so that's why it's a dialectic between logic and epistemology. So a logical opposition occurs when you have a categorical proposition if they have the same subject and predicate terms and they differ in quality, quantity, or both. Now notice we're restricting categorically to just quality and quantity. We're not talking about relation, and we're not talking about modality. Second thing, consider the kinds of opposition that can arise with differing quantity and quality. Okay, this is how we have to be able to evaluate the square. So the first case, they differ in quantity and quality. So those two categories at the same time. They differ in quality, but not in quantity. And then they differ in the quantity and not the quality. And then case four would be same quantity and quality. Okay. So let's start taking a look at the square. So in the square, you have A to E propositions. A is in the upper left of the square, E in the upper right. And then in the lower left, you have I propositions. And the lower right, you have O propositions. Now, let's cover what can possibly happen here. Four corners represent the four basic form of proposition. And again, this is recognized in classical, indeed categorical logic. Categories only of quantity and quality. Now, well, I'm not going to go into another discussion there about using modality, but one can generate these with modality. I've done it in the past, but right now we're going to stick with that. So A propositions or universal affirmatives take the form of all SRP. E propositions or universal negation take the form no SRP. I propositions are particular affirmatives that take the form some SRP. And finally, the O proposition, or a particular negation, take the form some SR, not P. All right? So the four corners of the chart then represent those four classical propositions. Now, given the assumption made with categorical logic that every category contains at least one member, following relationships are going to hold. First, A and O propositions are contradictory, as are E and I propositions. Now, what does that mean? Propositions are contradictory when the truth of one requires the falsity of the other. And, of course, conversely. Here we can see that the truth of a proposition of the form, for example, all SRP, implies the falsity of the corresponding proposition of the form some S are not P. So, for purposes of authentic biochemistry, let's fill in those variables, okay? If the proposition biochemistry explains all living events, A, is true, then the proposition biochemistry does not explain some living events, O, must be false. Similarly, if biochemistry explains no living events, that would be proposition type E. If that's false, then the proposition biochemistry explains some living events, I proposition, must be therefore true. Okay, so now we've established the landscape. Now, it's been argued that nature teaches form, and form creates ideas that developed the imagination into a faculty of reason. And we know that reason demands information empirically as a means to define order from nature. And often, at least classically, mathematics has been used to provide the means to begin the process of an ordered speculation about phenomena. So ultimately, sense data, sometimes referred to as empirical input, after transformation via patterned recognition reception happening a priori in the central nervous system, can be formulated into aggregated and, of course, then abstracted concepts, then populating what is known as the faculty of understanding. And that population within the faculty of understanding are called concepts. Now, the mechanisms used to carry out that process I just went through requires a third component of the mind. Now, sometimes called mentation, sometimes called simply thinking. Now, my new term for that is intralocution, or having a discussion within your own mind. Right? Intralocution. Now, somewhere in this process, symbolic logic, like we were just using, arises. And it's going to be used as a tool to develop hypothetical deductions that can be unambiguously, as far as we can derive them, tested to generate evidence, such as in experimental design and execution thereof, to increase understanding, ultimately yielding what can be referred to as a transcendental means for a priori justification of true beliefs, ultimately folded into knowledge, where knowledge is justified true belief, you see? So we just carried out the justification process there, right? Now, I adopt those transcendental movements that I just went through, but with the requirement that logic, which we just went through, precedes mathematics, okay? First through symbolism, and thence through categorical logic and the square of opposition. Notice there was no mathematics in my whole discussion of the square. It wasn't necessary, but you can certainly derive, because we're talking about quantity and quality in that square of opposition, you can certainly derive mathematical formula from any kind of propositions, obviously, right? So it can be quantized. So that's why I say math didn't come first, right? It's logic that comes first, a priori, okay? So this is an ontological pathway. So again, ontological meaning beyond even phenomena. So ontological mean what is. And what is can occur a priori to the observation of phenomena with the five senses. So it's an ontological pathway. If you want, ontological pathway is similar to the transcendental method of Kant, for example. In other words, you're bracketing off all the individual characteristics and you're trying to understand the form of the system, right? Classical forms being, of course, space and time, right? And then the categories follow there underneath those two major forms. So the ontological pathway for interpreting the world, that is, of course, endowed in each individual human being. And where does that come from? From God. So free will is an absolute requirement for this paradigm. It's absolutely required. Otherwise, how can you develop an ontological understanding ultimately of your knowledge base? Because whose knowledge base is it? It's yours individually. So even when you're in a classroom, you're in a biochemistry classroom at the university, you're a student, you're sitting there, you're taking notes, and the professor's up there and they're explaining about, oh, you know, acetylcholine carboxylase, its regulation by citrate, right? It's polymerization. In fact, it's activated. You'll take down those notes, and you'll eventually add together all the other understandings of, say, fatty acid synthesis, and you'll come up with a nice collection of information that you will then go home and study. You'll be reading literature. Maybe you're looking at primary research literature. If you were in my class, that's mostly what you'd be doing. You might be using a biochem textbook as a reference as well, specifically to look up nomenclature and, you know, pathways, that kind of thing. You have to memorize everything at the same time that you're trying to get concepts. But you see how that works. It is still free will driven. It is your knowledge base. So that's why it's absolutely essential. So it's the absolute requirement for what I can call basically a metaphysical paradigm, Because without it, there's no intentionality. And thus, there's no imagination how you'd ever get the process started. Why are you in the classroom? Why are you learning biochemistry from this long-haired professor? You're there because you want to be there, right? And you're not going to do well unless you want to do well. So it's all a matter of free will. So free choice of the human will in this understanding I have about metaphysics in general is the a priori first principle from which all dialectical event ontology is conceived. So in the natural biological sciences, I find free will driven discovery as the root of the tree of our knowledge of living systems, as directing dialectical, logical analyses and then syntheses. And that would be a component of the intralocution. See? So, way I see it, it goes like this. Free will to observation, to intuition. Intuition is another word for sense data. Generating idea, populating imagination, explaining composition, used to begin an understanding of order, generating temporal and structural sequences, formulated into logic, then the potential for maths then producing either directly from equations or from symbolic mathematics to pattern recognition receptors to abstracted concepts, filling in the understanding, then this process again of intralocution, which involves both reflection and cognition. And there'll be a temporal signature there all through this. Then finally, a hypothetico-deduction, generating experimental design and then the execution of the experiment, providing data that can be formulated into evidence, and then the last movement is induction. Okay? So, another way to look at it is like this. Observation, ingestion. It moves to ingestion, moves to analysis, moves to logic, moves to quantification, qualification, modality, and relationship. Now I've added all the categories. To inspiration. And the inspiration gives you a simple dialectic. As above, so below. Then you end up with, if this is all about biology, right? Remember, this is about biology. Then you end up with the discipline biochemistry. And from biochemistry, you then dissect inheritance, genetics, phenotype, plasticity, elasticity, and epigenetics. And within that process, if you have a clinical origin in mind, you can go from physiology to pathophysiology to disease in your discovery at the biochemical level. So hence I adapt this hierarchical ordering as my view that requires categorical logic to derive biochemistry from nature, observed nature, a priori to the study of such things as genetics and physiology, which rely on symbols to produce, in the case of genetics, surrogate genes to explain what are more basically and indeed ontologically biochemical events. So from that argument I just generated for you, I conclude that biochemistry is the authentic author of physiology. Okay? Now, let's proceed. Galactan 3. Again, remember the beta-galactoside, binding lectin family. We talked about it before. We talked about it having a carbohydrate recognition domain, right? Okay. So Gal-3 binds to ligands on the cell surface, also extracellular matrix, or also any cells that are in circulation. And when Gal-3 binds to any of those surfaces, it will modify cell-cell and cell matrix adhesion properties. And at the time that is occurring, what also can happen is receptor activation and turnover, generating cell signaling, promoting inflammation, cell proliferation, differentiation, and potentially migration. Okay. So galactan 3 is a pro-inflammatory protein. And I just gave you the sequence of events, how it functions. You know, in a symbolic form, right? Pro-inflammatory protein, and you find it a priori at the early understandings of the induction of many human diseases. Okay. So Gal-3 has been demonstrated to be not only a very common pro-inflammatory protein, but also unique in its role in processing very specific aspects of pro-inflammation, which involve lipid endocytosis, macrophage activation, monocyte chemotaxis, cell adhesion, and then that can lead to multiple sequelae, including atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease. Now, Gal-3 is also involved in the pathogenesis of non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. And in fact, Gal-3 double knockout mouse model studies show there is a resistance to the development of steatosis and fibrosis in NASH. And that occurs because the Gal-3 knockout has decreased fat deposition in the liver, which results in decreased oxidative stress. Okay, so now that's a knockout. Now, you know I have caveats about knockouts, because that's not a natural phenomenon. To knock out a gene is a good way to discover perhaps the function of that gene, but it doesn't necessarily tell us anything about what happens in the early stages of a pathogenic state, right? Because we're not likely to have a double knockout of a gene. So knocking out a gene, I've always tried to emphasize, once I started, you know, working in homologous recombination decades ago, is that there are proximal and distal events associated with a knockout. Because when you knock out the gene, all the signaling that leads to, for example, the expression of that gene at the transcriptional level, right? Talk about transcription factors and response elements and nation RNA synthesis and then maturing the RNA and splicing and putting it out there on the cytosol or into the ER for translation. All that's going to be altered if the gene isn't there, if it's knocked out of the genome. Plus, I can tell you that no matter how clean a knockout might be, such as substitutional homologous recombination events, they started up doing in yeast and then they eventually moved into mice, right? Knockout mice using negative selection and whatnot. Keep in mind that it's not as clean as you might think. That even because you're introducing after selection, negative selection is what we use normally to find out whether or not it was a good clean knockout. You're still going to get other insertions of incoming DNA when you do that homologous recombination. And that means there's no way to know where in the genome you might have had other impacts because you're not studying the entire genome, right? You're only studying the gene you're trying to knock out or knock in, right? So that's a huge caveat whenever you look at these studies. And I want to say that because often, you know, it's supposed to be like a mic drop. Oh, well, the double knockout shows it's the GAL3. If you get rid of it, there's no steatosis. Even like in the mouse model, the way they develop steatosis, you know what they're going to do. HFD, high-fat diet, right? Which I told you doesn't work in humans, right? But anyways, that's how they do it in mice. Okay. And they get rid of GAL3 and they don't see steatosis after giving an atherogenic diet. And they're saying, well, obviously cause-effect. And I'm saying with a great amount of caveat. Okay, but still, it's an interesting data point, you see. It's an interesting place maybe to start off thinking about it. Now, does that mean I want to set up a whole set of experimental designs and write a grant proposal for it? Not yet, you know. But obviously, this research has already been conducted. I mean, I'm talking about a paper published just a year ago in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry. That's what's going to be in the show notes. That's where we're getting to this paper. Right? So... let me see where we want to go because I'm almost finished with this first lecture for today. CD68 positive macrophages, common macrophages, expressing galectin-3 were significantly reduced in patients diagnosed with steatosis and NASH. Okay. But the number of smooth muscle actin, alpha smooth muscle actin, GAL3 positive cells actually increased with severity of fibrosis in children with not NASH, but with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which we think normally is part of the continuum, right? So NASH is typically strongly associated with what's known as meta-inflammation. But all this complex molecular interaction with GAL3 mediating the development of, say, steatohepatitis obviously is not resolved, right? Because of what I just told you about the NAFLD versus the NASH component and either high levels of GAL3 and low levels of GAL3. Go back to the square of opposition, you'll see what I mean. You now have a contradiction, right? Yes, you do. Because if the idea is that all GAL3 will induce NASH or even steatohepatitis, not necessarily non-alcoholic, but just steatohepatitis in general. And then the inverse of that would be the universal negative would be no GAL3 is involved in that, right? Those are only contrary points of view. But going on to some alterns is where you run into trouble for a contradiction. Because here I'm telling you, you get the opposite effect. But it's not necessarily NASH, but it's NAFLD, which you know typically is within the sequence of generating NASH. Now, again, that's younger people versus older people, and there's a lot of other caveats to that too. But the reason I bring all this up and the reason I did the whole pro forma, prolegomena of discussing square of opposition is once again so that when I'm going through these papers, you should be using your reasoning skills to also go with me and dissect to try to interpret whether or not the hypothetical deductions that are used to even do the research are valid and sound. Okay. So this is Dr. Daniel J. Guerra in Authentic Biochemistry on the 23rd of March, 2023. almost noon on a Saturday. Saying bye for now.